today in Democratic politics in particular, the fact that Black voters are such a bedrock of the party and actually have so much influence in the party is largely because of Jesse Jackson, period. Right. I mean, he registered millions of voters. He brought them into the political process. He created this foundation of political activism in the Black community that is still present today. But also young voters, to your point, I mean, so many young people started voting in those elections, some of them because of Jesse Jackson. And I remember because I was covering Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in 2016 and in 2020 as well. And I remember covering those campaigns and I had so many people telling me, you know who used to get giant stadiums full of young people in their presidential campaign before Bernie Sanders did? Jesse Jackson.
That is CNN's Abby Phillip, host of Newsnight. A really terrific conversation about her new book about Jesse Jackson and the importance that he has in the history of American politics. And she's talking there specifically about his influence on Black voters. Really, really love the conversation. It's a terrific book. I highly recommend it. Before we get to that, on tour, go to my website, paulmercurio.com, doing stand-up. I'm going to be in Phoenix. I'm going to be in just outside of Detroit, Key West, Florida. We've got dates coming in Annapolis. And go to paulmercurio.com and follow me at paulmercurio. And, of course, Permission to Speak, my Broadway show directed by Frank Oz, we have online on Patreon and on my YouTube channel. We'd love you to check that out and see it live. And we tour with that as well. And just a personal moment. I don't know what's wrong with me. I live in New York City and I'm finding now if I'm walking down the street and just by coincidence, there's a person walking next to me at the same speed, it really irritates me because then it either forces me to change my speed or confront the person about their speed. And I'm really walking because I want to be alone. If I wanted someone to be with me, I'd have my wife or I annoy her. So maybe hire somebody to walk with me. So I find myself, I'm walking next to this person and suddenly I'm in a relationship with them and I don't want to be in a relationship with them. And I'm getting more and more agitated internally. And then I start to take this weird ownership of my speed where I want to basically say to the person, hey, this is my speed. I established this speed for me. You get your own speed. So I think I have some sort of a problem that I need to work out with a therapist. But that's where I am at this point in my life. If you see me walking, walk past me or walk behind me, but don't walk with me. All right. Enjoy Abby Phillip. Really great conversation. And she has a terrific show on CNN. And people should watch it, whether you're on the left or on the right. She's very objective and a straight shooter. All right. Enjoy Abby. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week, Abby Phillip, host of CNN Newsnight, has her debut book out. Congratulations, A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power. It's great to have you on the show to talk about your book.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a bio. It's a political history book. It's social commentary. It's like, I think it should be required reading in colleges, in high school, because I think it's great you wrote about Jesse Jackson because I feel like he's fallen through the cracks of political history a little bit. And I'd like you to talk about the coalitions that he built because you talk about these unlikely coalitions and how he was this bridge from the activist movement to the political power that that especially Black politicians enjoyed. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that one of the things about Jesse Jackson is that he's everywhere and yet kind of still there are parts of his life that people don't really understand. And I just thought this part was so important and also maybe one of the least understood aspects of what he did. And you talk about the coalitions, and I think we take for granted today that that we have coalitions to be frank. Mm. I mean, back in the 80s, what Jesse Jackson was doing that other politicians were not doing was talking directly to not just Black voters, but Asian American voters, Arab American voters. He was saying to all of these different groups, come into the political process, not necessarily pandering to them, but just saying, you are a part of this story that I'm telling about what the future of the country should look like. And that's a subtle but important difference. I think sometimes people feel like there's too much pandering. But I think what he was doing was actually saying, you are who you are, but we all have a lot in common. And
we all have a stake in this.
We all have a stake in this.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, it just wasn't something that politicians were doing then. And frankly, not a whole lot of politicians do it well now. So, so there's a lot here that people can learn from.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too, is he was so far ahead of his time vis-a-vis the young voters in social media, right?
Yeah.
Like he was, and you point this out in the book, and when I'm reading, I'm like, oh yeah, she's right. Like young voters were fairly disenfranchised. I think to some extent in the late 60s, early 70s. And he was so charismatic and just, you could not take your eyes off him. So well-spoken and had such a powerful message that he brought in these coalitions. How much of his coalitions do you think shape American politics today? Do they withstand the test of time? What's changed at all regarding them?
Yeah, I think they do largely withstand the test of time. I mean, I think first of all, today in Democratic politics in particular, the fact that Black voters are such a bedrock of the party and actually have so much influence in the party is largely because of Jesse Jackson, period. Right. I mean, he registered millions of voters. He brought them into the political process. He created this foundation of political activism in the Black community that is still present today, but also young voters, to your point. I mean, so many young people started voting in those elections, some of them because of Jesse Jackson. And I remember because I was covering Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in 2016 and in 2020 as well. And I remember covering those campaigns and I had so many people telling me, you know who used to get giant stadiums full of young people in their presidential campaign before Bernie Sanders did? Jesse Jackson. And they would say that to me. And I was like, that's, you're right. You know, and a lot of people don't know that. Was that they were shocked that Bernie Sanders could do that based on that populist message. And the reality is that Jesse Jackson did it before him 30 years ago. And
As a black man, in a still very racist kind, like it's insane.
Yes,
it's insane.
I made a point to note to point out in the book that the KKK was still marching in Georgia when Jesse Jackson was running for president. So this was not some kind of like enlightened time for the country. Right. I mean, it was still a lot of really raw racism out there, but he was still able to do this extraordinary thing. And I think that the Democratic coalition is the one that Jesse Jackson envisioned and helped make a reality. However, I do think that Democrats are at risk of having that coalition fraying. And that's why this moment is so significant for the Democratic Party, because I think it can be a real pivot point for them if they don't figure out quickly how to get the right message and the right policies that really reach people.
They also have to understand that they've lost some of their coalitions. I remember growing up as a kid, union people were Democrats.
And
farmers were pretty much Democrats. And Latinos were pretty much Democrats. And it's like, you're losing it. It's the fabric is unraveling before you. And Jesse Jackson to do this at that time in the country as a Black man, let's get in the weeds a little bit. Talk about some of the skill sets that, how was he able to bridge this, to create this bridge, to build this coalition? You know, he had to have strategy. We talk about rules. You talk about governing in the book. And the second part of that question is, if MLK hadn't been assassinated, do you think he would have been transitioning, or he would have transitioned from political civil rights activism to politics? Because he certainly was charismatic.
I mean, look, those are two big questions. So the first one, I mean, I think the basic skills that he honed in on. When he first started running in 1984, I don't think he really understood quite what the message was. He was talking a lot about voting, but it transitioned to a much more economic focused message. So before the economy, it's the economy, stupid. Right. He was talking to people about their day-to-day bread and butter, basically saying to them, you know, this is a system that's rigged against you. You have the government operating for the rich and the wealthy and spending all this money on all of these foreign wars and not on you and your communities. And it's not working for you. And he could take these complex economic ideas and he could make it understandable and relatable. And he was a master orator. And I think that is not to be forgotten, because he made people feel things. When you go back and watch those convention speeches in 84 and 88, the whole room is crying. He moved people in the way that he was able to speak to them. So the combination of the economic focus and the ability to persuade and to move people emotionally was so key. And to answer your question about Dr. King, no, I don't think that he would have ended up where he ended up in quite the same way, because it was Dr. King's assassination that catapulted him from being one of the youngest of King's disciples to being a national figure literally overnight. And it forced him into this sort of position of leadership that, frankly, he wanted. It was very controversial at the time, but it put him in a different stratosphere of figures. And I think the fact of his celebrity in the 80s is what allowed him to be a Black man to run for president in this way. And he was very, very famous at that time and would not have been, I think, had Dr. King not been killed. And he was sort of set up in a way to kind of step into the gap that was created as a result of that.
I seem to remember that within the Black community, there was sort of pushback on him becoming a politician and becoming this celebrity, that it was, he was turning his back on the movement. And talk about that. And to me, the inherent tension of, if you're a civil rights activist, it's about making promises and sticking to them. And if you're a politician, it's about maybe not always sticking to your promises and compromising. And in civil rights activism, you can't really compromise in a lot of areas because these are black and white issues, no pun intended. How did he work around those two competing sort of inherent intrinsic values of those two roles? And did he do it effectively?
I think that he struggled with it mightily in the 80s when he was running for president. He struggled to see himself as a politician. I think he still saw himself as, as a faith leader, a moral leader, a movement leader. And there were many times in those campaigns when there were political decisions that needed to be made that would have helped him had he made them. He should have put Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam leader, to the side. And he struggled with that decision in part because he saw himself as somebody who, you know, wouldn't cast aside anyone, no matter what their political views. And so he really, in those campaigns, to be honest, never quite got there. And that's perhaps one of the reasons that it was hard for him to break all the way through. He never saw himself quite that way as a politician. And it wasn't until later, when in the early 90s, it came time to decide whether he was going to run for president in 92 or whether he was going to endorse in that race. And Bill Clinton came to the Rainbow Push Coalition and had the sister soldier moment and embarrassed Jesse Jackson and kind of reprimanded Black people. And it was a huge controversy. And Black Americans were like furious about it. Activists who were close to him. And Jesse Jackson later on endorsed Bill Clinton. And I think that was the moment when you really started to see him seeing politics as a vehicle where he could work from the inside in order to get the things that he wanted. And I think that's where the shift happened.
Well, he was in a tough position because, you know, he had a moral center. And he comes from a religious background and you know, you live by the Bible, which is, you know, Jesus's teaching, you don't turn your back on anybody. And at the same time, you've got to play the game and play it effectively, which means you kind of have to be cold hearted and cold blooded at times. So you're right. I think he was trying to be, he was forced to try to be all things to all people. And when you do that, it's tough to sort of get to the finish line, but you do talk about this idea of a deferred dream, which implies unfinished business, and touch on that a little bit and how far we've come or maybe regressed since Jesse's 80. And by the way, I should tell people the book focuses significantly on the 84 and his 88 presidential elections as sort of the foundation for the conversation. But talk about the unfinished business part of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a lot of unfinished business. I mean, I think this is a moment of a lot of transition politically where the working class is up for grabs. Both political parties are now fighting for that slice of the electorate. And the Democratic Party has figured out one part of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, which is that they want their party to be diverse racially and ethnically and gay people and lesbians and all that stuff, all of those people in the party. But what they haven't figured out is how to do that while also addressing the sort of bread and butter issues of people's economic lives, which really isn't just about money. It's about their future. It's about how they see themselves. It's about their sense of hope for what they can accomplish. And I think that that's been the struggle. That's been the struggle, is doing both things at the same time. Now, we see on the right, you have Donald Trump running a campaign that is also economic populism. And he's also started to gain inroads with some of these minority communities. And I think Democrats now have some competition in that respect. And they've got to figure out a message. Mm. And I think this book is partly about the fact that I think many Democrats thought that was a done deal and they had figured it out. And I think that there's an argument to be made that they haven't, and that think about how many politicians really can do both things at the same time. I mean, even Bernie Sanders did the economic piece very well, but struggled to get a diverse coalition together that could win a Democratic primary. And so who can do them both is a big question.
So that leads into, and we're going to wrap in a minute. I know you have to jump, but right into sort of the idea of, if you were advising a politician today, you, based on what you know of the history, Jesse Jackson's legacy, everything that you've written about and learned in researching and writing the book, what would you advise them in terms of continuing and maybe even growing the legacy of Jesse Jackson?
Yeah. I mean, look, as a politician, I think he is a lesson in what authentic connection can do. Yeah. And I think politicians who really speak to people at the heart and soul level really break through. But I also think that there is no substitute for speaking directly to the things that will improve people's actual lives. And when I went back and I listened, I read all the reactions from voters at the time. I loved that part of it because you really hear in people's voices, just everyday people, what they really thought about these candidates. And time and time again, they would say about Jesse Jackson, he's the only person that's talking about me. He's the only person that's talking about how this system isn't working for me. And I think so many politicians are kind of stuck on like reciting lists and not speaking directly to people's experiences.
And doing this when they point. Who points like that? Stop. Like, yes. Stop. Like, just if you can make somebody at home feel like when you're talking to them, which is what's so great about your show, is you feel like they're talking directly to them. You're there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard. I mean, it is hard to do. I think people, it's about the policy, but it's also about whether the policy is actually responsive to what people are feeling. And I think he was a master at that. And it's just an art of politics. I mean, the politicians who are good at that, the Bill Clintons, the the Barack Obama, the Donald Trumps, the Ronald Reagans, they do well.
Yeah.
Because they're able to really get to the heart of what people really know to be true. People are not wonks, but they know what's real to them. And if you can capture that, mm-hmm. that's the ticket.
People are very intuitively smart. They may be not IQ smart, but they know they can smell a charlatan a mile away or somebody that's totally sincere. So the book is really great. I'd love to talk to you more about it. Maybe we do another one of these down the road when you're not so busy, but it's a book that everybody should read. It's the long overdue Jesse Jackson, A Dream Deferred. Abby Phil, congratulations on your debut book.
Thank
that's
you.
So awesome.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking some time with me this morning. Thanks.
Absolutely. Great to have you on the show.
There you go. That's Abby Phillip. Terrific conversation and terrific book. Please follow me at Paul Mercurio on social. Again, go to my website, paulmercurio.com for tour dates. And also keep an eye out for my Permission to Speak show. We've been doing it online on my YouTube channel and on Patreon. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Abby. And we will see you next week.